Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's choosing to join us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and of most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland, Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives. And secondarily, because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we would appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. And then I can turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. Alternatively, if you would like to reach out without calling in directly, without being on the show, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, and or you can email Jeannie at jeanie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And if we get a comment or a question from you, we'll address it on the internet show. And then, as time allows, we'll send you a notification letting you know what day and time that occurred on the show so you can listen back to the archives for your feedback or input. And we greatly appreciate it whenever anybody chooses to do that, because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be of service, and that's just a whole heck of a lot easier to do when we get input about what's really landing well for you and what is of most use for you, and the choices we're making of how we explore different topics on this show and spend our time. So today's Wednesday. We had a support group last night. We had some very active processing going on. And discussion, and it's just a gift, and it's a free gift. If you or somebody you know would like to take part in that, all the information you would need to be able to join us either on Tuesday or Thursday nights from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time is on the website at mindshiftersacademy.org. And there's a lot of deep processing that goes on in those support groups, and there's a lot of, at this stage of the game, in August, we'll finish 20 years of doing that Tuesday group. So there are some really well-practiced people who've been using these tools for a lot of years. So there's lots of good wisdom and input on how to get maximum benefits from the application of these tools. And there's also the pretty good odds that whatever you're going through, somebody in that group has gone through something similar, whether it's difficulty with parents or children or work or self-image. It's very the depth and breadth of the experience of the people that attend these groups is quite remarkable in my personal experience, which now spans 50 years of doing therapy in various ways. So feel free to join us or pass that information along to somebody you think might benefit. Area code 541, you're in the air.
Yes, Celinda here. Good morning.
Hello.
I so wanted to get into the conversational fray yesterday, but I also didn't want to interfere with the process that was being done with Magda, Susan, and you. I thought it might be good to express how I see the situation about your facilitating me, since I was the one facilitated.
Well, no one here is going to stop you. you're an uninvited guest, but you're a guest nonetheless. So go ahead.
I am unstoppable. I think I'm the unsinkable Molly Brown or something. I'm not sure. Anyway,
so what's your input for this beating a dead horse competition?
my input is that, and this comes from my experience with Touch for Help, is that basically what you facilitated from my point of view, me doing, was balancing myself and aligning myself back into alignment with Rahma. I was chuckling when Susan and you were dialoguing, because as I've mentioned to you before on the show, that I am exploring this middle path. How do I stay in the middle, have the widest panoramic view I can, allow and really experience the actuality that all events are neutral? So this is my input. I agree totally with my, how would I put this? I know that the work I did was my work. And I also am very aware that you had a work you were doing which was facilitating my process and staying out of the way as much as possible by and at the same time by gently guiding me and supporting me in the process. And I choose to thank you very much because I feel what we were experiencing with the co-creative process, I felt like your skills in facilitating furthered my process, and I am hoping and anticipating that you also got a balance. You also got a worksheet experience out of my experience in some way or another for yourself, either as a facilitator or if something resonated for you within yourself. So I'm really happy with your facilitation. I thank you. I am grateful for your facilitation. I am also thankful and grateful for my work that I did and for the co-creative process that both of us entered. As for shooting, that's another thing that I am working on. I am working with my shooting, my fixing, my controlling behaviors of which I feel my shooting comes from, because I've observed that when I'm shooting around, I get a lot of shit on me. So I just thought I'd share that with you. No right, no wrong. And if you don't want to accept my thanks, that doesn't invalidate them for either you or for me. And I am very grateful to allow you to be who you are, and me to be who I am, and Susan and Magda to be who they are. And that's it. That's my little tiny spiel.
All right. Well, you're very welcome and deserving. Thanks for the input. It is, that's, since you were at the center of that magnificent piece of work, it's nice to have your thoughts on it. And that'll be that.
Right, and I did want to share also with you, Dr. Tim, that I went back and I re-listened to the show, and I redid my worksheet, and I had those three thoughts on it, that I wanted to be loved and nurtured, and I can't remember the other two at the moment. One was, I will be killed, and there was one other one, I want my mother to be gentle and kind with me, or something like that. And I had done the worksheet on one of them, but I went back and did two more worksheets on the other two thoughts, and I came up with a convergence of all three around the areas of punishment and what kinds of effects of punishment have on my body and my functioning. So anyway, I thought I would share that with you, and thank you very much. You are very welcome and deserving as well.
Thank you. I'm glad that the work is still bearing fruit for you, and it's the nature of this work that it only works if we work it, if we pick up the tools and use them. So congratulations for being willing to do that. And I'll look forward to further processing if you choose to share it.
Oh, cool. And I will be in the support group as soon as the weather, and I carve the space out and the weather, and I am actually in the garden. So consistently. So thank you so much. And enjoy nature as she shows up.
All right, will do. Anything else for you today?
No, I think that's it. We have to run off to Baker City, so listen to the rest of your program, then I'll catch Michael and Jeannie's later, sometime today or tomorrow.
All right. Blessings. I'll mute you so you can listen to the rest of the first hour here, and I'll invite one of the many other people on the call to raise a hand and weigh in or talk about how you would like this particular next 45 minutes or so to go. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1 on your phone, we can have a conversation. And these shows, these episodes, whatever you want to call them, have a much better chance of making the highlight reel when people just like you call and offer a comment, a question, a thought for direction, a clarification, even a refutation of what's being offered. I have lots has been going on in the past few days in the I think the biggest theme for me has been the idea of people who want to know and they want to be right and they want that they want to hold on to the idea that their particular ideas about how their life should unfold is right. And whenever it doesn't go that way, the world is wrong. Life is wrong. And I'm grateful for having stumbled across tools like this that let us know from a very, very clear perspective over and over again that we've been given a feedback system. We've been given a guidance system, which you might call it your guidance system. You might call it your emotional energy system. And whenever that emotional energy system is giving you an experience that's less than loving, it's absolute evidence, it's irrefutable evidence in that moment that what you're doing with your free will and your choice of mind energy is the thing that's producing your discomfort, that nothing outside of you produces your discomfort. And so, you know, it doesn't matter whether I'm having a whole series of what I would call unpleasant or unwanted events in my life, whether that's, you know, the mental or physical illness of someone I love, or the breakdown of the appliances in my house, or the way the politics are going, or but whatever is happening that I then judge as bad or wrong or should not be there, and in that process, I begin to experience a tightness or a tension or a pain or a discomfort. These teachings let us know that the very best use of that experience of tightness or tension or discomfort is as irrefutable evidence in that moment that whatever we're choosing to do with our mind energy is not accurate. It is literally what is producing the discomfort that we say we don't want. And the sooner we can bridge the gap from what we've been taught by our culture to this ability to question and question whether or not, try it for yourself, observe for yourself, what happens? How does your life improve or decrease in things that you prefer when you pretend that this is true? And the more you pretend it's true and you get results, it's like Guy Finley says, you can't take a step in life. You can't test out your theories in life without life responding in a way that lets you know, irrefutably know, whether or not you're stepping into the truth or you're stepping away from the truth. So it might be absolutely just one big pile of hooey that life is okay just the way it is, and that your choice of the way you apply your mind energy is what's causing your emotions. It may not be true. But I can say this much with certainty, that if it wasn't the case, then there would be no reason for me to ever think anything like a reality management worksheet could be productive for me. Because if, in fact, what is happening in the outside world, what is happening in the natural world, what's happening with my friends and relatives, what's happening in the politics in the world, what's happening with my physical body's aches and pains, if those are actually what's causing my emotions, then it's just completely ridiculous to think that without affecting any of that, I could do a worksheet process and then affect any kind of change in my emotional state. So the actual proof, they say the proof's in the pudding kind of thing, the actual proof for me that the worksheet process, or that this observation about how I'm the one that's creating my emotional state and my reactions to things, the proof of that is right there in the fact that any worksheet process can work at all, whether it's Byron Katie's worksheet or Diedrich Wolzak's Choose Again worksheet or Michael Rice's Reality Management worksheet. If I was not the author of my emotional state, it would not be possible for those worksheets to affect any change in my internal emotional state. So this is what we're offering, suggesting, asking people to observe, trying to practice for ourselves in this work, that my choice of how to apply my mind energy in any given moment is the actual mechanism that creates my response, my experience of life in that moment, and my emotional state, etc. And if you observe that same thing to be true for you, then you might thoroughly benefit from the application of this reality management worksheet and the mind shifter targeted journaling tool, etc. I think I mentioned that I'd been using the archives recently over this past weekend. And one of the older audio files I listened to was titled Truth is a Pathless Land. PATHLESS. Truth is a Pathless Land. And it was broadcast originally on April 11th, 2019. So almost 5 full years ago. Tomorrow it'll be 5 years, I guess. And whatever happened, and apparently it was just a monologue of a show. Nobody called in, I don't believe. But whatever happened, I was led to read the writing by Krishnamurti that he later titled Truth is a Pathless Land. And in the beginning of that, he told the story of how the devil and a friend were walking down the street, and they saw someone stoop over in front of them and pick up something off the sidewalk. And the friend said to the devil, "What did that person just pick up?" And the devil said, "Oh, they just picked up a piece of the truth." And the friend kind of shuddered and said, "Oh, that's going to be really bad for you, isn't it?" And the devil said, "Not at all. I'm going to let them organize it." And with that little story, with that little parable, with that little myth metaphor, the layers and depth of truth in that little story, that's how Krishnamurti opened his talk, in which he said pretty much the opposite of what everyone listening wanted to hear. And I don't know, maybe it's just a coincidence that that's part of what I'm called to do from time to time on this show is say things that are pretty much the opposite of what people want to hear. But at that point in time, those people had gathered to listen to Krishnamurti, who'd become a very, very popular worldwide, you know, international, we'll say, spiritual teacher, because wherever he went, whether it was in Europe or Africa or Asia or the United States, hundreds of people would come to listen. And this is before the internet, long before cell phones, and, you know, this is still plane and ship travel was very common. This was in the 40s and 50s. And they were hoping, they had been trying to build to a crescendo where they thought when he decided to have this talk, he was going to come out and announce that he was the most recent incarnation of Jesus, of the Christ. And they had created this order of the star, and they were, you know, they were meditating and they were teaching, they were following what Krishnamurti said, and they were building this spiritual community, and they had followers, and they would, you know, initiate people into the order of the star, and it was a great hoopla. And in that talk, Krishnamurti came out and said, I'm not who you think I am. I am not any great spiritual teacher or leader. I'm disbanding the order of the star. I don't believe that you should be following anybody. And the truth that you're looking for cannot be found by following someone else. The truth you're looking for can only be found by looking inside yourself and noticing what is actually true in your life and what is false. Seeing the false for what it is and seeing the truth fully for what it is. And if you wanted to tap into that talk, if you go to the mindshiftersacademy.org website and click on the page that has the title Audio Library, the very last file on that page, the bottom file on that page, is titled Mind Shifters Radio Podcast, Truth is a Pathless Land, April 11th, 2019. So it's available. It's there. You can listen to more of the talk. You can listen to more of what Krishnamurti said, or I was reading at parts of the transcript that he had, the transcript of the talk he gave that day when he disbanded the Order of the Star, when he went against what hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of people were hoping he would say and do. And walked away from the notoriety, the quote, power, close quotes, that was being offered to him by these people who wanted to put him on a pedestal and turn that set of teachings into a religion or a religious group, etc. And it may just be a coincidence that that's one of the audio files that I listened to over this past weekend. It may not. There might be some synchronicity in it. I don't know. And yet, it's always useful for me to repeat that what we talk about in this work is a set of tools that every individual can get access to and start applying in their life so that every individual can gain the practice and strengthen their ability to tap into their own connection to the wisdom that, as Guy Finley says, can help you, that will never abandon you if you just ask to be taught by it. This is the the thing that Michael Rice in the Kabor's manuscript references might call Ruka Dakucha, or it might call the sacred breath, or it might call the Christ mind. Your higher consciousness, God, light, love, as Krishnamurti says, and Guy Finley says, I'm repeating what Guy Finley says, I don't care what you call it. It doesn't matter what you call it. People have called it a variety of things for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's all the same stuff. And it, whatever it is, this dynamic, this connection you have to the wisdom that can guide you to how life really works and what your true nature is and what's most useful in your life, is not a person. It's not an entity that gets jealous. It's not anything that you would benefit from treating it as though it has human-like qualities. And yet, you can benefit beyond words whenever you decide to practice your ability to tap into that wisdom, to get access to your own internal access point for waking up. And the waking up part is basically waking up to what's actually true and waking up to letting go of what's false, to seeing the false as the false, as Krishnamurti would say. And in Krishnamurti's work, he was crystal clear about the fact that your thoughts about anything are not the same as the thing. And there is an inherent flaw in the process of thought that keeps most of us stuck, because we create some kind of a discomfort, we create some kind of a negative emotional state, and then we think, well, I thought my way into this problem, let me keep thinking until I find a way out of it. And David Bohm, the physicist, and Krishnamurti, the spiritual teacher, both recognize this. And what they were teaching, the way they were talking about it, was so similar that David Bohm's wife had found out about Krishnamurti and knew what David Bohm was talking about and writing about. And she said to David Bohm, you got to talk to this guy. You guys are saying the same thing. And the physicist was just dumbfounded. He said, how could that be? How could a spiritual teacher be saying the same thing I'm saying? And lo and behold, when they got together for a talk, that's what they discovered. There is this thing that David Bohm has called sustained incoherence, which is the same, you know, dynamic that Krishnamurti discovered in the errors of thought that create our pain and suffering and keep us stuck in trying to make things different by doing the same old thing over and over again without realizing how much we're doing the same old thing over and over again. And that's one of the benefits of Byron Katie's worksheet, where she says, question whatever your thoughts are whenever they're negative, and question them at deeper and deeper levels. And that's the same core as the dynamic in Michael Rice's reality management worksheet. I cancel my need to be right. I cancel everything my conscious logical mind is telling me to do, and I ask to be shown something else. Asking how difficult it is for the Western mind to get comfortable living in the question when it's been trained so, conditioned so heavily with both reward and punishment to try to know, to try to get somebody to agree or disagree with them so that they can know who's right and who's wrong and what's up and what's down and it's pretty fascinating when you stop to think about it and you learn to question everything you've been taught. And it is quite the it's quite the koan right there in itself, right? The idea of a koan being a statement that seems to be contradictory of itself. A statement like, no ignorance, no end to ignorance. That's a koan. And it seems to say both things, that there is no end to ignorance. Ignorance is everywhere. And it seems to say there is no ignorance. How could both of these be true? Well, this is one of those statements that's a koan, that is a teaching at many different levels. So if you decide that you're going to sit with that thought and look at all of the different ways that it might make some sense or have truth in it, you can be shown, you can get revealed to you different levels of meaning from a koan. It would seem to be a koan to say that, as one physicist said, one of the hallmarks of any deep truth is that its opposite is also true. Now, that would seem to be a direct contradiction. It would also seem to be a direct contradiction to say, you know, our science is what allows us to have cell phones and airplanes and motor cars, and yet our science, the more it learns and the more it starts to show us what it's learned and what its theories are, it tells us, you know what? The more we learn, the more we realize that we don't really know anything. How could that be true? Well, they've got these theories about how the universe exists and functions. And the more they look at those, the best of their instruments, they say, you know what? Our best theories tell us that we can only see and measure with our instruments about at most maybe 20% of all the energy and mass that's in the universe. And if you're like most people, that very statement seems to be a ridiculous statement. How can you say that there's 80% of the universe that you can't even see or measure, and then how would you even know it's there? Well, because the best theories they have for how the world works from their scientific perspective don't work unless there's another 80% of life, of energy, of mass, of matter, whatever you want to call it, that they can't measure directly. So if we're living in a world that our best science can only show us about 20% of the world, and within that world, our five senses can only show us a tiny fraction of what they can measure with their scientific instruments. And then our conscious logical mind in any given moment can only give us a tiny fraction of a fraction of what our senses are registering. It is the highest silliness to say, this is what I know. I know this or I know that. And anybody who says they know, in that moment, cuts off the possibility of learning and expanding. And now we're back to that statement, the koan, no ignorance, no end to ignorance. If I insist that I am not ignorant, if I insist that I know, then there's no end to my ignorance because I can't learn anything new. I keep myself locked in ignorance with the very process of demanding insisting that I know. So whether it's Diedrich Wolzak's worksheet where you ask to be shown, or it's Michael Rice's worksheet where you ask to be shown, or it's Byron Katie's worksheet where you ask to be shown, or it's the Sedona release method where you ask questions and just wait on the answers, or if it's the IFS work, the internal family systems work, where you just get curious about what is driving this part of you and ask it to share itself with you or its motivations with you. Asking and learning increasingly to be more and more comfortable with this state of openness and questioning without, as Rilke would say, without demanding an answer, is probably the highest order of wisdom, enlightenment, spirituality that anyone could enter into as a practice. There is no way that any one of us, or even all of us together, with the brain power of every human on the planet, that we could know enough to be able to predict how things are going to turn out or how it's going to be a blessing when this unfolds or that unfolds. It's just not possible. There's far more going on here than any one of us or all of us combined can know about. And if I decide that's bad or wrong or shouldn't be, then I create a tension within myself. I create a constriction within myself. In that moment, I'm no longer an open conduit for the energy of love and light to express in the world. I've created a discomfort or a constriction within myself. And that's the opposite of what the Way of Mastery is calling us to do. Bring us back to the opening in the Way of Mastery before we ever even get to the lessons. It says, here's a promise. If you want to wake up, if you want to be enlightened, if you want to expand your consciousness, if you want to be one with Christ or know God, whatever it is that you want to label that, there's a special writing from, you know, this channeled work from Yeshua that says, I promise you this. If you become totally committed to awakening from the dream of separation, this dream that you've dreamt as a soul, as a consciousness, before the first stars began to appear in the heavens, if your only desire is to be what you were created to be, then all you need to do is put down on the altar of your heart, lay down on the altar of your heart, with every breath, lay down everything you think you know, and lay down everything you think you need, and learn to look lovingly upon every place that fear has made a home in your mind. If you do that, allowing the correction to come, it will come. It's not you doing it. It's not how you do it. It's how you allow it. But even before they get into the third lesson in this work, Yeshua is channeling, the channeled entity of Yeshua says, look, I began to be seen as a rebel because I chose to quit striving for God, striving for enlightenment, and move into the process of allowing. And that's what's happening right here in the promise before they ever even get into the lessons from the Way of Mastery. And it lays down, it tells us to put away everything we think we know. It's inviting us into a divine ignorance to recognize how little we know, how little we've experienced from this physical realm of what is and what is potential, and to put away everything we think we need, every desire, every goal, put them all away. And the last step is find a way to to see that everything that's happened in your life is completely neutral. Dissolve and dismantle any place that fear has made a home in your mind. Fear, or any of its stepchildren, any of the other negative emotions, judgment, blame, guilt, shame, vengeance, fear, anger. Do these three things and allow the correction to come, and it will come. It goes on to say right there in the promise that then the day and the moment will arise and all of your pain and fear and suffering will have vanished like a wind that pushes the foam of the wave away. And it will reveal the clarity of the ocean beneath you. It will reveal there is so much more going on here than your conscious logical mind and your thoughts about yourself and the intellect that has been shoved full of trivialities by your language and by your family and by your culture and by your life experiences. It will be cleared away. And you will have direct access to the flow of life through your open heart space. You will experience what goes beyond words prior to each new heartbeat. And you might have some memory of the dream that you dreamt. But it will be such a faint echo that it will leave no trace upon you. In your heart, you will smile very, very lovingly and gently, regardless of whatever circumstances you find yourself in the physical body. There will be peace from the crown of the head to the tips of the toes. And that peace will walk ahead of you wherever you go. That's from the promise, a writing at the beginning of the Way of Mastery, before the lessons even begin. It calls us to live in the question at levels that words cannot describe. It calls us to do that questioning, that being wide open, prior to every breath. And it comes with a promise that says, if you do this, what you're looking for will come, will be your experience. And it won't be you doing it. It will be you allowing it and receiving it. And therein lies the rub for most of us in the Western mind and our extensive conditioning, both punishment and reward for getting it right, for knowing the answer, for figuring it out, for winning the argument and having our day. We have all been conditioned to think that's a good thing to do. To know, to be able to conceptualize it with the conscious logical mind and language, to be able to win the debate. And yet this work says, and several other great spiritual teachings say, you can't know with your conscious logical mind. You can't force the world to be what you think it should be without getting an increase in pain and discomfort as your result. Air code 610, you're in the air.
Hi, Dr. Tim. This is amazing, and it addresses exactly what's going on here at my house, because I'm reading The Laughing Jesus, and I've gotten to the chapter that says, the most famous man who never existed. And I figure, I haven't even read it, I'm assuming it's about Jesus, and he may be saying, he's dismantled everything about the Old Testament, how it's this and that, and Moses and Solomon and David, they might have existed or these places might have existed, but they're much smaller, and it didn't happen this way, and it didn't happen when we think it did, and the whole thing has been all made up. And I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, I should be upset about this. This is the foundation of all that I think I believe in. And we have Michael Rice, who is teaching the Aramaic meanings of or sayings of things Jesus said, as if Jesus existed, and yet I'm reading this book which says none of it existed. It's like we've thrown out the guru, and what are we left with? I'm finding that I don't mind a bit if it's all thrown out. And I don't know whether I'm crazy, but everything you say fits what I think I'm about to read, and I might be totally wrong, but here I am at a dilemma. I've got my youngest grandson, who's got OCD anxiety, called me from college and said, Orb, I'm going to church, and I gave my life to Jesus, and I feel so much better. I'm having so much less anxiety, and I've made some wonderful friends who also believe the way I do. And he's asking me, what do I think about homosexuality in the Bible? And do I think it's a bad thing? And he wants to have all these discussions, and I can't tell him what I'm reading in this book. That would dismantle something that he's got hold of that's really helping him right now. I don't know where I'm going with what I'm saying to you, Dr. Tim, except that maybe you have to get to a certain point where you can throw it all out and realize there's something there beneath all that that is true and to be trusted. I guess I'll stop talking.
Well, I would absolutely breathe and soften and say it's perfectly okay for you to do your own work and not try to share it with especially someone like your grandson.
Right.
And just say, I'm so glad you found what's working for you.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're doing, you, Susan, personally, what you've been doing in the 7 or 8 years that you've been doing this radio show work, et cetera, is pretty intense stuff, right? And it's shaken you at your foundations multiple times. So it's not something that, you know, like you were saying the other day to me, if somebody asks you who you are and you tell them, I'm the extension of love in form, that would be intrusive, right? Well, trying to get your grandson to dive into a book like Timothy Freakin, Peter Gandhi's The Laughing Jesus and some of their conclusions.
That would be a disaster.
Well, it might not be anything that's useful for him. It's like the kind of thing we used to talk about when you know, in the early days of these internet shows, when people would ask me things, I'd say, look, you know, let's just meet people where they are, right? That's what's important here. I wouldn't go into a kindergarten class and start trying to teach them particle physics. And the fact of the matter is that the science that I know tells me that there is no matter, it's all energy, right? But if somebody comes to me and they're in one of my therapy sessions and they're, you know, Dr. Hayes, my car broke down, it's on the side of the road, and I couldn't get to work, and now my boss is mad at me and threatening to fire me, and I'm generating all of this panic, and I'm not going to have a discussion with them about how there is no matter, everything is energy. Particle physics tells us that this thing they call a car is mostly just empty space. And I'm going to deal with them where they are.
Right. Uh-huh.
And how they might, as a person, if they believe themselves a solid person in that moment, how they might be generating their anxiety and give them some tools, whether it's the breath work or canceling a goal or two, or some EFT tapping that might help them. I'm not going to talk to them about how, you know how the guy that created EFT tapping, he said that in a few years it's probably going to be obsolete because blah, blah, blah. It's irrelevant. I'm going to try and meet them where they are. And that's what I would recommend you try and do with your grandson.
Oh, definitely.
And do more listening and questioning with him than trying to teach him what you've already learned.
I agree totally. But I'm watching this book. I don't know whether this guy, these guys who wrote this book are right. I'm not a historian. I have no way or no interest in checking out the years that Solomon did this and where he was and whether he existed or not. It's funny, I'm not interested. Why is that? You'd think I'd be just hanging on to that. It doesn't mean anything to me. I don't understand why it doesn't mean anything.
Well, just think about what we were talking about in the monologue before you turned on your microphone.
Yeah, that's exactly what you were talking about.
It's the thing that, what does it matter? It doesn't matter. What matters is, what am I doing with my mind energy in this moment to see my true nature and then be able to extend that loving nature to others?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I going to get all puffed up with what I know is right, and I'm going to try and shove it down somebody else's throat, and I want them to agree with me, and if they don't, then they're ignorant, and...
Yeah.
That's the only thing. That's what I have control over. I don't have control over what the history of life has been.
Right. Well, it's almost as if all of these events and people existed and taught what they did, we're asking for trouble. If they really existed and we grab hold of that, then we have limited something profoundly so that we make a mess of our lives. We almost have to give it all up, every shred of it, and have nothing left.
Well, remember, you might remember that sometime in the past week or two when I was talking about the Anthony DeMello book, Awareness, he was talking about how we can't achieve what the teacher, Jesus, Yeshua, taught. We can't achieve what he achieved in his life if we just mimic what we're told he did in outside actions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as a way to talk about that, Anthony DeMello says, you know, when a monkey picks up a saxophone and manages to make it make noise, it doesn't make him a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what most of us are like when we try to imitate the life of our favorite teacher or our favorite spiritual master or whatever. We're doing imitation. And and the great spiritual teachers, the great masters, they weren't imitating anybody.
Yeah.
They learned for themselves. The Buddha, how'd the Buddha get to be who the Buddha was? He went out, was born into wealth, lived that life for a long time, saw something else, decided, I'm going to go to the other extreme. I'm going to go live poverty. I'm going to go renounce everything, physical, et cetera, sexual, and everything else. And he lived that until it almost killed him. And then and then he tried something else and ended up with the middle path.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's not that he was imitating some great saint.
Right.
Pick any of the great teachers, they aren't an imitation of anything else prior to them. They might have learned a little from here and there, but then they go off and they do their own thing and they live in observation and they experiment and they get feedback from the world, and that's what we're being called to do, to live in direct observation in the moment, to learn to live questioning, to learn to have an experience of yourself. So somebody says, you know, your true nature is love. Well, with that and $5, you can get yourself a bag of organic carrots. But if you want anything of value, you have to find a way to usher yourself into an experience of your true nature as love. And then you've got to take the time to be acting from that true nature and just observe, hey, do I prefer this to the results I get when I try to mimic some great teacher or live by belief? etc. So that's our show time for the first hour. I will mute you. Thank you so much again for your comments, questions, and responses. And I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Kim. Awesome discussion. Great response. Appreciate you.
You're welcome and deserving. Have a great show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. And today is, what is today? Today is Wednesday, April the 10th, 2024. And our calling number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And we will give Michael just a moment to dial in and welcome those who are out on Podbean listening and downloading. We appreciate you out there as well. And Michael has joined us, so I'm going to say welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Delighted and honored that you're here once again to join us in this conversation about first century Aramaic forgiveness, and in particular our work with the book Enlightenment, which is what we've published so far from the Kabor's manuscript. So delighted you're here to be with us, and Miss Jeannie, I'll check first and see if you have any questions from any of our external sources or anything happening in the chat room. Anybody with a hand up in the phone queue?
No, it's all quiet on this end, and I think we've addressed all the emails and the comments that we've received from the app, and there's nothing going on in the chat room, so I'd say just go for it.
Cool. So we're in the dictionary toward the back of the book, page 76, and looking at definitions of words, and then we're going to move forward and go through the select passages where those words are applied. And I guess let's just start right at the top of page 76. A root word, EEK in Aramaic, speaks of a mindset, or a lot of the Aramaic language a la translation, and this translation work was done by, back in the 70s actually, by 25 of the world's top Aramaicists, and the objective was to establish the first century meanings of the Aramaic words. It's interesting, some translations, or what purport to be translations of the Aramaic, actually were done by folks who were set in a Greek-oriented so-called Christian atmosphere, and then went back to the Aramaic and started to translate and brought all of that information, all of those brain cells with them. So what we're looking to do is to get a fresh look at all of the individual words and then ultimately end up with what are the tools, what are the processes that Yeshua presented for working through the generational patterns, the cultural patterns of hostility or fear, and arriving back at the place where we truly function as human beings. And our definition of a human being is one that is extremely difficult to capture in any language, and so we suggest an experiential definition. And if we look at, you know, how people are functioning in the world, we're looking at people who are pretty much tainted, you know, one of my favorite expressions. And it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it's actually really more literal, is that by about the age of 4, in this culture, most everybody is so enculturated in blame that they are literally very devout, card-carrying members of the one world universal religion of blame. And so in blame, we don't find human life. Human life is made, we're told, by the ancient teachings in the image and likeness of love. And then, and this is the best definition I've been able to come up with for a human being, and that is just hold one that hasn't been tainted by all the garbage of the world, that hasn't been enculturated, that hasn't been brainwashed, that hasn't been made an object of desire by the culture or by people in the culture. So hold a newborn. Go back to the moment, you know, if you've already done that, and hold a newborn child. And let yourself bypass everything of your own mind and your own emotions in those situations, and allow yourself to just imagine holding that newborn. This, I would offer, is an experiential definition of human life. And a question that Jeannie and I have asked quite literally of tens of thousands of people all over the globe in all kinds of different cultures, everybody pretty much comes up with the same descriptors for the essence of that newborn. And it's words like sweetness, purity, the most common word being that of love. And virtually every other word that people use are some variation on the theme of love. I think that makes it a pretty safe bet that that word is about as close as we get in the English language to describing our essential human nature. Confront one of the mega, major errors of the culture where the word love has been destroyed and turned into something that it is not. Just take a look, you know, what's the number? I think something in the range of about 60% of so-called love relationships, marriages in our culture, end in divorce. Was it a love relationship? Was it based in the sweetness and the purity and the love that we as human beings are? Or do we live in a culture, and this is a proposal I'll make, we live in a culture that has become specialized at knocking the experience out of us of ourselves as love, and then along about the age of 16 or so, sending us out the door to find somebody to love us or find somebody to love. You know, think of that song. Don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? And on and on and on it goes. But that's not what the word means. If you look at that idea of the word, what you'll find is that it's a venial form of a venial form of approval. Notice people come together and they're all shiny and new and they are experiencing themselves somewhat as love, but then when their partner resonates some form of hostility or fear in them, what happens to the so-called love, the approval? The approval's withdrawn, and the blame begins. So, no, those are not love relationships. Some of them, because people come together that don't have much hostility or fear, seem to work out fairly well. But they're still not love relationships, unless they're based in a person experiencing themselves as a human being, as the presence of love, and experiencing those around them as the same. And then go back once again to that moment where you held the newborn and tapped into their essence, and then ask yourself the question, is this newborn loving me, or is this newborn love? And it's pretty clear that the newborn isn't loving you. The newborn is a being created of that essential energy called love. And so recognizing that that's who we are as humans, my offering is that the objective of this text that we're working with, the objective of this ancient teaching, because the world wasn't much different 2,000 years ago than it is today in this regard, as people were functioning out of so many variations on the theme of rage and guilt and abuse that love didn't poke its head up very often. Love, I offer, is our human lives. What we're working to do with this particular study and with the work we've garnered from the Kabor's manuscript to offer people back the tools for them to experience themselves as we truly are, each of us, and to give the tools that were offered to remove those assaults based in hostility or fear that we've each received and end up perceiving ourselves and each other through those assaults. So the objective here is to develop a mindset that matches the Aramaic mindset, where when they said to Yeshua, what's most important in the law? He didn't say to love your neighbor. That's the bastardization of the word. What he instructed people to do, he gave them a tool for experiencing themselves as love. Said you've got to have rachma. This is a condition in the frontal lobes of the brain that supports us experiencing ourselves as the active presence of love. And once you have that experience, then my offering is, the objective of this work, is to support you in removing every assault that's ever happened in your life, every experience of rage or fear or guilt or pain or drama or trauma that has come into your experience either through your interaction in the culture, your interaction in your family system, or what's been implanted in your genes that never belonged in a human set of genes. So to apply forgiveness in that regard is the objective of this work. And so the top word on this page 76 in the dictionary in the book Enlightenment, EEK is a root word, and it speaks of a mindset. Again, this Aramaic, when you go to the Greeks, they didn't have a clue. The Greek translations, these mindsets, this idea just, you know, I can remember being a kid and hearing about the Beatitudes. Well, it's a nice story. It's a nice philosophy. But actually, that's not what it is. It's about a set of instructions for how to maintain a mindset that guides you to happiness and well-being, how to maintain your human life. So it becomes a whole different project than the Greek and the Latin stories had to water down the brilliance of this man's teaching to the level of its own understanding of the teaching, of its own cultural and word meanings. So many of the words in Aramaic are explaining mind structures, explaining literal neural structures that are active in the mind that produce certain forms of behavior, decisions and behavior. So this particular word speaks of a mindset, and I don't know of any other translation of the Aramaic that goes to this depth of comprehension of the meaning of these words. There is nowhere that I've seen this level of comprehension. So this root word eek is a mindset or a mind structure underlying the judgment behavior we describe as hostile or malicious toward other beings. Now, we have a word in our culture that kind of matches this one. This is one of the areas where you can see that via experience, people have gone, oh, there is a certain mindset that leaves people in judgment and behavior that's hostile and malicious towards other beings. How do we say that? We don't have a word like this, a root word, eek, as they do in Aramaic. what's our expression of this? We say, oh, he got out of bed the wrong side this morning. He's got a certain mind structure active. Well, the Aramaic language was expert at describing these mind structures being active. And when a mind structure is active, it directs perception in a certain direction. It directs life in a certain direction. And there's certain mind structures that are desirable and certain ones there aren't. And this is one that isn't. This is one that doesn't support people living as human beings. The thought comes, there's a film out there, if you haven't seen it, entitled I Can Only Imagine. Very powerful film. It's about a young man who, as a kid, his escape from life was music. Pretty abusive childhood. Music was his thing. And he ended up, after all kinds of drama and trauma and interaction with his father, who was brutal with him, yep, going on the road and ending up becoming a Christian museum, pardon me, musician museum, a Christian musician. And wrote all kinds of beautiful stuff, and in particular this one song. But it's interesting, if you watch the film, and it's a true story of this kid's life, his healing did not come from his interaction with Greek translations of the words of Yeshua as were presented in all of these churches that he sang in. His healing came when his father, who was so brutal, decided to do some work in cleaning up his own mind. And there's a very profound scene in the film where the kid comes back and he's still, you know, he's been doing all this churchianity stuff and he still is peeved. I would use a different word, but I'll avoid it. As he's ever been, and still is enraged with his, quote-unquote, with his father as he's ever been. He's still a young man filled with pain and rage. But his father's made some changes, moving toward, not perfectly yet, but moving toward living as the presence of love. And the film demonstrates very well how in that space, the son begins to heal. The son who's so enraged that he's ready to just run away from his father and has nothing but just putrid energy toward him. But when the father starts to show up his love, the thing that sort of stimulated me on this was looking at, if you look about a third of the way down the page, and we can look at this word gmir. All-inclusive. The Aramaic word for perfect is spelled substantially. Remember, there was a quote that said, be perfect. The Aramaic word for perfect is spelled substantially the same, but phonetic marking indicated the word in Matthew 5:48 is not perfect, but all-inclusive. So when we experience ourselves as active love, if we've done the work of the Aramaic Yeshua, you know, the person who hears about this statement saying, be ye perfect, is going to try to do all kinds of things to live up to somebody's standard. But when you recognize that what was being asked in this particular passage had nothing to do with being perfect, as the world would express it. But if we go to Matthew 5:48, thus let your love be all inclusive, even as that of your Father in heaven is all inclusive. So what's being said here is that when you recover your human life, no matter who, no matter what they're doing, you will hold to your human life because it's what you are. It's not what you do. can't love you. You can't love me. I was talking to someone yesterday, and they'd been around this work for the last 30 years, and they were calling and saying, this has just changed my life so much. And, Michael, I love you so much. And kind of tongue-in-cheek, I said, well, actually, I want to let you know that I don't love you at all, and I know that you don't love me, that that's just not true. And they were kind of like, well, what are you talking about? Well, let's get back to who we are. Are you love, or do you do love? Behold a newborn. Is a newborn love, or is a newborn doing love? And so when you recognize who you are, this particular passage that's referenced in the dictionary on page 76, and when you go back and look at it, what it's saying is you are continuously embraced in an all-inclusive energy field called love by the Creator. And your job as a human being is to be that presence of all embracing love for anybody and everybody and everything that you look at. Well, Michael, what if some terrible, horrible thing happens in the world? All the more important that you show up as a human being rather than as a set of reactions from your genetic past and carbon-based memory that supplants your ability to function as love with some form of judgment, horror, terror, fear, trauma, drama, hatred, whatever. So once we recognize that our job, you know, I think we could take this Matthew 5:48 and recognize this is the job assignment. Experience yourself as the presence of love. And when you can't stand in that presence, recognize that you have a mental illness. And your mental illness is whatever the response is from carbon-based memory that blocks you from functioning as conscious, active, present love. Apply forgiveness to that and return to the space where you can function as active, present love. Now, when you see how rapidly, how instantly the mind can come up with its rage and fear games, then you see how quickly love can be displaced by hostility and fear. So on day one, when you get this idea and you start to move toward the experience of yourself as love and bring that forward into your world wholly and fully, no matter what's going on in the world, there's going to be failure after 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 failure. I've been doing this work 50 years and I still have failures in that regard. And more when that failure comes up, and when I talk about failure, I'm talking about losing the ability to hold to my own essence as love, because I still have a carbon-based memory system with 1,000 generations of what have my generations, what have your generations experienced. This work of Yeshua is not for wimps. It's not something where you say one day, oh, okay, I'll be one, and then it's done. It is an ongoing process of growth into recognizing that every response from anywhere in your bloodline that is unlike love is yours to forgive, so that your love, your presence, your being stays present and is all-inclusive for whoever, for whatever, for however anyone shows up. Can I bring the light of the active presence of love to this world? That, if you look at it today, it's pretty bizarre and it's pretty insane. If I can, and here's the thing, rather than anyone comparing themselves to somebody else, can you do a better job of it today than you did yesterday? Can you hold to active present love even when your breath resists and all of a sudden some sort of fear or rage or guilt or pain or drama comes forward? Some sort of mental illness. And all of those things are mental illnesses compared to living as a human being that whose presence of being, of love, is all-inclusive. and recognize that that state of all-inclusive love already exists for you to link into. It's called the Creator. Now, those who've never done the work of Yeshua will tell you about how the Creator is wrathful and vengeful and is going to take vengeance for you. I remember I did a workshop. Actually, the first time I was in a town of, it might have been the second time, right next to Theodosia where our teaching center is. And there was a gentleman that was teaching a course on law that I went to. And he was very much into Old Testament and vengeance. Like, nobody pulled one over on this guy. And if you tried, he'd make sure to get even. And I had attended his course, and I talked about this work with some people. And that word got around, and he invited me to do a workshop in the context of what he was doing. And I did the Y workshop. And afterward, he was like, "Oh, Michael, this is so wonderful. Thank you so much. Now I can stop taking vengeance on people, because if I forgive, then God's going to do the vengeance for me." Ah! No, George, that was not what I said. But that was how his mind read it. That was how his perceptual construct ran. So this whole, let's just look at the last few words of this particular passage in Matthew 5:48. Let your love, let the presence of active love in you be all-inclusive, even as that presence of love from the Creator is all-inclusive. There is no vengeance. There is no anger. There is no disappointment. There is no pain. There is no trauma. There is no fear. There is no intimidation. There's no getting even. There's no judgment in the Creator. There is simply the all-inclusive presence of active love. This is the mindset. This is the core mindset that comes from Rachma, that we're looking to find enough words in the English language with the state of the world today to bring this point across. And that as we learn to hook up to that, and the way we hook up directly to that is through the breath. We have a direct connection to that all-inclusive love. And our direct connection to that all-inclusive love is the breath of the Creator. In Aramaic, where the Greeks tell us that the Creator sent out its breath, does not say that in, or pardon me, the Greeks tell us it sent out his spirit. It does not say that in Aramaic. It says the Creator sent out its breath. So you and I can directly connect to the eternal active presence of love in which we live, move, and have our being through breath. And I'll just say that in 45 years since I discovered for me the still point breathing process and been teaching it, I don't care how deep, how painful, how traumatic, how insane, how bizarre, how outrageous the circumstance is and the trauma moving within someone is, that breath knows how to quell that energy and bring healing. And it's available to us from the inside all the time. And so this would be a gathering of words to get the point across of what it is we're looking to do. When the Greeks the Latins told us about this vengeful, wrathful creature that instructed the murder of millions, and on and on and on go the atrocities. We're looking to do is to adopt the mindset that empowers us to comprehend, or I shouldn't say empowers us, because that indicates like maybe there's some empowerment out there somewhere. No, the empowerment is within us. It's uncovering the empowerment. Breathe into that for a moment and recognize that the empowerment to live in and as conscious, active, present love is inside of you. And the tool that will diffuse all pain and trauma in your life, close as your breath, and just allow yourself to just kind of be in the space of that and breathe. Connect your breath so that the in-breath and the out-breath flow as a unit. And recognize that there is an all-inclusive presence of love in our world. And all we need to do to follow the lead of that presence is to breathe. So join you in breathing. And notice that when some form of hostility or fear is triggered, notice what happens to your breath. And it is the shutting down of the breath that leaves us in trauma. You'll notice that the person who has, as the first word in this dictionary page, page 76, at the top of the page, eek, is a mindset or structure underlying judgment and behavior we describe as hostile or malicious toward other human beings. Notice that someone who's in that mindset does not have their breath moving fully. So if a mindset of some form of malice, eeky in Aramaic, and then if you just move down a little bit, about a third of the way down the page, before we get to Gemir, look at the word Gehenna as you breathe. A valley outside of Jerusalem where refuse was dumped, and where the fires of leopards excluded from the town burnt nightly. This is the word that's been translated as hell. As though love could possibly create a place in which people would burn for eternity. It was the Gehenna. It was a fiery place. It was a garbage dump, and they burned garbage there, and people who couldn't afford a funeral, were their bodies were taken there to be burned. It was an hellish place, and it was a threat they used with little kids, would take you to the Gehenna. Parents or the people's mind was not connected to active love, where they were not in this Gemir mindset. And they found it worked pretty well with little kids, so they created one for big people. And people are still running around threatening little kids. And And people are still running around threatening adults with a fiery place. A specific threat designed to inspire fear, which is the exact opposite of all embracing love. So in the name of all embracing love, we have people threatening the opposite. In order to get people to go to all embracing love or pretend to them that they're going to get there by being in this fear, it's such an insane conflict. So allow your breath to be restored to any part of you that's ever been threatened. Threatened by those who didn't know any better. With any form of punishment, what were you trying to escape from? What form of hell was it that you were afraid of? What form of fear was used to keep you under control? Breathe into it. And just at this point, as you breathe, tap into the highest, clearest, most powerful present love that you can. And letting go of the world for a moment, rather than having to take on the whole world and think of all-inclusive for the whole world, just allow yourself to tap into that presence of love and allow yourself to breathe that presence of love into every cell in your own structure. Just let that all-embracing love permeate your own body. And you do that by breathing into it. If thoughts surface that you deserve something other than that, or you don't deserve that, or you can't have that, or whatever, notice those are thought disorders that are lies, that don't support you living a truly human life. And just breathe through them and let go of them. And with your inner eye, notice that the trillions of cells in your structure, imagine you can see them, those cells, and in each one of them there is a light. And as you focus on them and fuel those cells with your breath, imagine and watch that light expand. As you breathe, just allow the light in each cell to expand to the borders of each cell itself. And as you fuel even deeper with your breath, imagine you can see that light expanding beyond the borders of those trillions of cells in your own structure. And experience the light moving in each of those cells, joining with the light in every other cell, expanding until your whole physiological system is filled with light. And then imagine that your nearest neighbor, the person closest to you right now, and remembering that in Aramaic, the word neighbor means anyone you think about. Imagine that they too are experiencing being filled with this light. And in the same way that the light expanded out from the cells in your structure and join with the light in other cells. Imagine that this light inside of you now expands beyond you and meets that expanding light from your neighbor. And by doing so, it joins and it strengthens as you breathe. And imagine that you're able to look out from your inner eye and see throughout your whole neighborhood. You see that light that is in each person in your neighborhood. Looking through your inner eye and imagination, the ability to image in this truth, you see that light expanding in each neighbor, joining in a light that encases the whole neighborhood. And so now every person in the neighborhood is reflecting their light back to you as you expand your light toward them. By the way, if you think that's an impossibility, let me just share a text that I got this morning. I had a young lady who's an attorney from Montreal, Canada, that had come down here last week and done a 3-day personal intensive. Young lady who's in her, I'm not sure exactly, 40s or so. And had never heard the words from her father of approval. He lives in a foreign country, other side of the globe. She went back to Montreal, having done some pretty deep inner work. And in her first conversation with her father over the phone from the other side of the country, this is a woman in her 40s, she hears from the first time, hears the words, "I'm proud of you." She shared that with me last week. The text she shared with me this morning was, "I've never heard those words from my father, and every day since I've gotten home, he said that to me on the phone. I've talked to him every day. And he's told me how proud he is of me." She'd been working that for her whole life, working for that. And now, as she has forgiven that part of her that put herself down, her father, literally from the other side of the world over the telephone, reflects the light, the truth back to her, that she is worthy. Imagine that every person within your neighborhood is reflecting their light back in your direction, as your love is all-inclusive. Fire that in others. And the light of each person within your community expands, joins with the light in each other person in your community, and that light just explodes out into the world. You'll remember there's a line in the worksheet that says, "When I choose love, it wakes up the love in everyone." This is a principle of physics. This isn't theology. The energy that you choose to expand literally touches others. And in the same way that if I hit a middle C tuning fork on a desk and I put it near a second middle C tuning fork, that second tuning fork has no choice. It goes into sympathetic resonance with the tuning fork that's moving, and it too starts to move. So allow yourself to breathe and be that all-inclusive presence of love, and watch how that light from your community expands out to the borders of your state. and breathe. Remember, this is not your breath. This is literally the breath of the Creator that you're breathing. And connect it even more deeply in your physiology. Notice if there are any tension points within your structure. But as you take the breath to those tension points, they soften. And when that tissue softens, the light within it expands and heals. And as the light from your enlightened community expands out, see it literally reaching out to the borders of your state and touching every person within your state. When you choose love, it wakes up the love in everyone. When you become the presence of love, the presence of love tends to expand out. And as you see the millions of people in your state, or if you're in another country, in your country, you see that light then redoubling and expanding out beyond the borders of your state or your country into surrounding states and surrounding countries. Know that we have people from all over the world in our conversation today. And see that light moving literally around the globe. This man, Yeshua, 2,000 years ago said, "I am the light of the world." And he expanded his light. And then the only thing he changed was a pronoun, and he said, "You are the light of the world. Go of the bushel baskets of fear, rage, guilt, pain, loss, and trauma. Let them be melted in the presence of this light and this love." And think about that. One person has been a major challenge for you. And then at the same time as you think about them, imagine a person that it's easy for you to extend this love to. And imagine that they are side by side. The person who's your challenge, the person that's easy to be loved in the presence of. And see the light that you extend to that person that's easy to be the presence of love for. Be extended and encompass that person that perhaps previously you've labeled enemy. And breathe. And notice that unless there's fear in you, some fear that perhaps you've projected onto that person, there's no inhibitor to extending that love, that all-embracing love to that person who perhaps maybe you called the enemy. And breathe. You are the light of the world. And as you breathe, notice whether or not there are any tension points within your own structure. Notice if there are any tension points that resist the presence of that love in you. Soften and breathe into those tension points. And as you do, you'll be restoring that light to your own tissue structure and to those who are a symbol of your resistance, those who perhaps you've called enemy. And just allow, literally allow yourself to follow this directive. Let your love be all embracing. Not perfect. Literally including everyone. 7.5 billion people embraced in your light. And because you've chosen love, it begins a process of resonance, that presence of love in every other person. And know that you are the light of the world. Breathing with you. There's any fear of that idea that we've been fed about the Gehenna, about the fiery place, allow it to soften within you and let the light in. And then as you breathe, we'll move from that word Gmir, all-inclusive, as in Matthew 5:48. And then we'll look at the note under the structure of it with the suffix that includes two I's, so Gmiri. And that suffix indicates this is a quality you possess. Because it is what you are. You are the light of the world. And then let's just go down a few word definitions to Himin. The structure of mind underlying the attitudes and judgment we describe as faith or trust, as in having faith in a true presence of all-embracing, all-inclusive love, in which you live, move, and have your being, the Creator. Not a religious idea, just the fact that energetically you live within the structure of all-embracing love. Just allow that in. And you remember how powerful a healing force that is. When you listen to Yeshua talking about that woman who needed to touch the hem of his garment to be healed, who felt that all she needed was that support and that extra energy boost. And you remember when they wanted to make him responsible for her healing, he said, no, it was her faith. Her expression brought about her healing. and know that you are one with what the Aramaics called Hemna, one who has fidelity, faith, and trust. So here you stand as the light of the world in fidelity, faith, and trust, ready for the next level of work, ready for the next piece of work that you individually are going to need to do in order to maintain this state. Thank you, you, the light of the world, for being with us today. And have the best year yet of your eternal life. Blessings.